WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sanctuary. According to the dictionary, it means a sacred or holy place, a place where worship takes place, a place of safety and protection. But safety is exactly what eluded Catherine Steinle last week when she went out for a walk with her father on the San Francisco pier and was shot and killed by Francisco Sanchez, a man who had been deported to his native Mexico 5 times and served prison time in the U.S. for drug charges and his repeated illegal crossings. Catherine's father spoke to ABC reporters about his daughter's last moments.
I could feel she was fighting, gasping for every breath, and she fought right up to the end, but that, I wouldn't expect anything less from her.
But adding fury to the poignancy over a young woman's death is the question about whether San Francisco's status as a so-called sanctuary city, where local officials set a high bar for cooperation with federal immigration officials, contributed to this tragedy. This hour on Point, the San Francisco pier shooting and the immigration debate. You can join us on air or online. How do you interpret this story? Do you see it as an isolated incident, or is it a symptom of a bigger national problem? Does your city have sanctuary policies, and how are they working? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. We want to hear more about the details of this story, and of course, we're going to dig into the deeper implications. But first, from San Francisco, with the latest is Carla Marinucci. She's a political reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle, and she's been following this. Carla, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So, Carla, we heard from Kate Steinle's father a moment ago. Could you just tell us a little bit more about the circumstances that led to her death?
Well, you know, this was last week on the Embarcadero in San Francisco, one of the most touristed, iconic, picturesque sites in San Francisco. She and her father were doing a tour of the city. They had just shot a selfie back to her mom, and she was shot there on the pier at 6 p.m., height of the day. It was a shock to the city, and even more of a shock when it was found that Jose Francisco Lopez Sanchez, who originally said he was shooting at sea lions, the gun was discovered to be belonging to a federal agent, a Bureau of Land Management agent that had been stolen a week before. At this point, you know, the city is still reeling from this, and I think the political implications are potentially huge still.
Can we go back to this whole question of what his intentions were and how he found the gun? I want to hear a little bit more about that, and I'll just play a short clip from Francisco Sanchez spoke with an ABC 7 news reporter, Cornel Barnard, from jail this past Sunday. I think a lot of people who saw the interview saw that he seemed confused, even when the questions are translated into Spanish. And here he was asked how he got the gun that he used to shoot Kate Steinle. This is what he said.
Mm-hmm. Where did you get the gun?
In the ground, when that's over there in the bench, and push the my leg, and I'll see the one teacher, and I'll see over there something like that.
So you found the gun on the ground?
Yes.
It was wrapped in a t-shirt?
Yes.
So since this interview was conducted, more information, as you told us, has arisen about the gun and how it belonged, you know, to whom it belonged and so forth. Can you tell us any more about that?
Well, yeah, it's really unclear at this point. Mr. Lopez Sanchez has changed his story a couple of times, originally saying that he fired the gun intentionally. Yesterday, he pled not guilty to this crime. His attorney said that the gun went off accidentally. So I think we, in terms of how he found the gun, we're still unsure whether it was in fact in a t-shirt wrapped in the street, as he said. He also said he had taken a number of sleeping pills that he had found in a garbage can right before the crime occurred. And I think everybody's still piecing together the stories, and there have been changing stories from Mr. Lopez Sanchez
about his intentions and what was
exactly
actually going on in his mind. Can you tell us any more about him? You know, was he a violent felon a la the presidential candidate, you know, business mogul Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and this is a man who has been through the justice system since 1991, when he was arrested in Arizona on inhaling toxic vapors, and since then in and out of prison, has spent 15 years in prison, about a third of his life in federal prison for illegally entering the country, and in five different states. The last incident was here in Victorville, California. He got out in March, and that's where this whole story takes a terrible turn, because there was a warrant for a old marijuana arrest, a 20-year-old marijuana arrest, a $20 street buy in December 1995. The Bureau of Prisons sent him to San Francisco because of that warrant, and San Francisco, of course, the Sheriff's Department ended up putting him back on the streets. What's the interesting turn that we found out yesterday was that, you know, the Sheriff, Ross Mercurimi, who has railed at the Bureau of Prisons, who has demanded to know why federal authorities returned Lopez Sanchez to San Francisco on a 20-year-old charge, it turns out it is his own department that asked the federal officials to do so. They requested custody of him. They even sent private transportation to Southern California to bring him back to San Francisco, only to put him out on the streets 3 weeks later.
I was going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you, why was he in San Francisco? Because there's been a lot of different reporting around this. I mean, it has been reported that he deliberately wanted to go to San Francisco because it was a sanctuary city and he felt he wouldn't be deported. Is that true?
So. Well, he said he has returned to San Francisco a number of times, where he was kind of a street person, slept on the streets. We've seen he's been in shelters and so forth, because he said he had faced less of a chance of deportation in San Francisco. In this case, the Bureau of Prisons was about to let him out in Victorville. He had served 3.5 years, and they contacted San Francisco, as they said they were required to do because he had that outstanding warrant, and San Francisco Sheriff's Department said, yes, we'll take him, and, as I said, sent transportation to get him, only to find out the district attorney said, look, this is a 20-year-old charge. Under our sanctuary city laws and city ordinance, I can't hold him. There was no communication between the Sheriff's Department and the Bureau of the Immigration and Customs Officials, and that is another case where this whole story went awry. The city mayor yesterday just blasted the Sheriff's Department, saying, couldn't you at least pick up the phone? There's nothing in city ordinances that prohibit you from having communications with immigration officials.
Could you talk a little bit more about that, this whole question of what a sanctuary city is and how different jurisdictions in California interpret this? Could you kind of help us understand this?
You know, California is home to the largest number of undocumented immigrants in the country, estimated more than 2 million. And San Francisco has been, you know, the city of St. Francis has been open its arms to immigrants of all kinds. And for years, this has been an issue protecting immigrants from deportation, splitting up families, trying to establish trust between law enforcement and undocumented immigrants. There's really no definition, legal definition of sanctuary city. So with about 320 jurisdictions around the country, they all interpret it their own way, some by resolution, some by law. And so in 1989, it was then Mayor Dianne Feinstein, today U.S. Senator, who signed what was then called the City and County Refuge Ordinance. It was designed to help immigrants seeking asylum from El Salvador and Guatemala, at that time internal war disputes, and then the law has been expanded over the years to cover all immigrants. And in 2013, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed an ordinance signed by the current mayor that prohibits city law enforcement from releasing undocumented immigrants to immigration based on a detainer request alone. Part of that, Michelle, was because there was concern about the Federal Secure Communities Program. Critics said that this policy under the Obama administration had created tension between immigrant communities and law enforcement, that some immigrants were being deported, ripped away from their families, even if they hadn't been convicted by anything, and in some cases, even people who had come forward to report crimes were being detained. So That's how San Francisco responded. The Board of Supervisors passed this tougher ordinance. California, at the same time, passed a law called the Trust Act that said only immigrants with violent or serious felonies could be held by federal authorities, and that those requests should be treated as voluntary.
And so, hold on a second. So, is the dispute here, or does this whole question turn on what is considered serious? Because there's no record of violence in this person's background, but are his repeated deportations and his repeated kind of revolving door approach to coming in and out of the country, is that considered serious? Does the question hinge on when the local authorities should that have been considered serious on its face?
Yeah, that is exactly the criticism right now, that there are some instances named in the San Francisco ordinance that talk about, for instance, sex offenders, very violent offenders, rapists, and so forth. But nothing that Mr. Lopez Sanchez did is covered by this law, and neither is repeated returned illegal entry into the country. He had several drug offenses, including heroin, marijuana, glue sniffing, and so forth, but none of those fit under this ordinance. And so, San Francisco went even further, I have to say, and its ordinance says only inmates with violent felonies in the last 7 years and facing another violent felony. So the law became very, very specific and very intense with regard to who could actually be turned over to immigration authorities.
Very briefly, Carla, if you would, can I just interrupt a second?
Yeah.
You're saying this has been a huge story, both in San Francisco and nationally, and it remains so. Can I just clarify that with you? It's still a huge story.
I think the presidential elections on down, this is an issue that could impact politics, and already we're seeing presidential candidates take this up, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
All right. Carla Marinucci, political reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you so much for joining us and giving us this important detail.
Thanks for having me.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about immigration and sanctuary laws meant to establish trust between local communities and law enforcement. And the question is, do these laws also protect the violent? Now, here now to dig into some of the deeper implications of this, joining us from Washington is Avida Mousavian. She's an attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, where she works on economic justice and immigration enforcement issues affecting low-income immigrants. Avida Mousavian, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle, for having me.
And joining us from New York City is Julie Myers Wood. She served as the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement for the Department of Homeland Security from 2006 to 2008. She's now CEO of GuidePoint Solutions. That's a consulting firm that works on, among other issues, immigration compliance and border services. Julie Myers Wood, welcome to On Point. It's a pleasure to speak with you as well. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Michelle.
Now, we've spoken about the fact that this shooting in San Francisco was a tragedy on its face, but it's also, as we know, it's become a political issue, in part because the issue has been elevated by candidates, and one of them is the Republican presidential candidate and also the real estate mogul Donald Trump. And he's talked quite a bit about this issue, and very controversial in some instances. He sat down for an interview with NBC's Katie Tour yesterday afternoon and expanded on comments he made in the speech announced his presidential race on June 16th, when he had some disparaging comments about Mexican immigrants. And he expanded on those remarks in this interview. And here's what he said.
They force people into our country, and they are drug dealers, and they are criminals of all kind. We are taking Mexico's problems. Mexico doesn't want to take these people. So what do? They send them to our stupid politicians, and we have sanctuary cities, and we have all of this nonsense. I've been saying this for a long time, and it's a disgrace.
You know, Avida, of course, there's a lot that I'm sure you would want to address here, but I'd like to ask you if you'd kind of focus your response on just this whole question of the sanctuary cities. I take it that you support these policies and that you think that they are productive and in the public interest. You know, tell us why.
Sure. San Francisco is not alone or unique in terms of having a policy like this. And I think it's been part of a national response. All these jurisdictions, over 300 around the country, that have said, in order for us as local police officers to be able to do our job, and our job is to be able to get reliable, credible information from our residents who feel comfortable and safe coming forward to us and who trust us, we need to have a policy like this that really separates our role from that of the federal government, and we shouldn't be viewed as immigration enforcers. And I think that San Francisco, like so many jurisdictions around the country, has said, you know, this is what we have found is working. It's what prevents crime. It's what helps us redress crime in our community, because singling out part of the population and saying that they shouldn't feel safe coming forward is ultimately going to erode trust for all of our community members, and it's going to make it harder for us to do our job.
Can you give us a scenario where you feel that this would come into play in, say, what, a domestic violence incident, or somebody who was a victim of a street robbery? Give us a scenario that you think where this comes into play.
This could come into play regardless of a person's immigration status. It may not be that the witness or victim to a crime themselves may, for example, have status, but they're afraid of family members or other residents in their community who may be asked questions, who are going to be singled out. You could have a domestic violence victim who wants to report a crime and is afraid of a cross complaint being falsely lodged against them. You could have someone who is a victim of a serious stranger crime on the street who's afraid to go to get medical services or to report the crime to the police. We have seen this time and time again, and it is precisely because of that fear and stories like that. And one incident of someone hearing about local police cooperating with immigration and someone going, you know, to the police thinking that they're going to be seeking protection, and instead that they're sort of swept up into the dragnet of immigration enforcement. One story like that has a really powerful ripple effect in communities, and it really creates a chilling effect in terms of being able to make people feel comfortable coming forward to the police. And I think that they recognize that embracing these policies.
Is it your view that the law enforcement benefit is outweighed by the potential liability, which is that it, in fact, creates a sanctuary for people who are not trying to have evil intent or who have a criminal intent? Is it your view that, you know, does it create a sanctuary for violent people is I think the question. You don't think so?
Well, I would say more important than my personal view is that the fact that law enforcement leaders around the country have been very outspoken in saying they think that these policies that detangle their role from immigration enforcement are what keeps their communities safer, and it's what helps them really police effectively and really engender trust in their communities. And this is also a view of the administration when they released the 21st Century Policing Task Force. The recommendations included a decoupling of immigration enforcement from the role of local and state law enforcement, precisely because they said in order to really effectively get that trust with community members and to effectively prevent crime, that's the approach that local governments should be taking.
Let's hear from Julie Myers Wood, who served in a previous administration, the administration of George W. Bush, as the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Julie Myers Wood, thanks for joining us as well. From your experience, and you were also a prosecutor before that, correct?
That's right.
Yeah,
give
us your perspective on this.
I think it's critical to build trust in all of the community, including the immigrant community. And so I think it makes sense to think about how can all of law enforcement work most effectively together. Unfortunately, this recent incident, rather than building trust in the community, the sanctuary city policy really undermined that trust. I think it's important to have kind of a national discussion about how can we deal with some of these delicate issues regarding immigration enforcement. Are there categories of individuals such as victims that we may not want to have any cooperation with federal authorities with respect to? And are there other individuals, such as individuals who've been convicted of serious felonies or other crimes, where we do want that cooperation precisely to keep all parts of the community safe?
Do you think, though,
I guess it's fair.
Yeah, but I just want to know, do you think this is a system problem, or is this just a kind of a bizarre, isolated incident where a variety of factors came into play to result in a tragedy? Or do you see what I'm saying? Is this just one of these bizarre isolated incidents, or is this a reflective of something bigger?
I think this is reflective of something bigger. Unfortunately, as Avedon noted, over the past few years, there have been a number of cities that have reduced their cooperation with ICE. And that has resulted in a number of incidents, tragic incidents, that could have been prevented if there was some state and local law enforcement cooperation with ICE. And what that's resulted in is workarounds, sometimes kind of behind-the-scenes maneuvers, because the men and women in the sheriff's department, just like the men and women of ICE, just want to keep the community safe. But I think it is a very fair and proper comment to think about how can we come together and can we do some sort of common sense enforcement that we all agree on. And it might not be as much as ICE would want a cooperation on, and it might be a little more than some cities, but at the end of the day, it would be a policy that would be designed to keep the public safe. And that's what ICE is trying to do now. They have developed a more nuanced policy, I think led in part by Secretary Jay Johnson, called the Priority Enforcement Program, which is a voluntary program asking cities to come together and agree upon areas in which there should be cooperation. But let me say more broadly, I think this failure to have cooperation and this disconnect actually underscores a broader need for immigration reform. When we can't kind of agree on the state of play, when there are a number of individuals that are here that are undocumented that many cities and others kind of want to have stay, we know we kind of have a problem with our system. It's broken not just in state local cooperation, but the immigration system, I think, is broken overall, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's interesting because in an interview that he gave with, again, we referenced this earlier with ABC 7's Cornell Barnard on Sunday, Francisco Sanchez, the alleged shooter, said that he came to San Francisco in part because it's a sanctuary city.
San Francisco is a sanctuary city. Did you keep coming back to San Francisco because you knew that they wouldn't actively look for you to deport you?
Yes.
So the question, though, I have here, and perhaps, Avedon, you want to take this, is that perhaps both of you want to address this. Is this a situation that it puts local government interests in conflict with federal government interests? I mean, the federal government has an interest in enforcing immigration law writ large, that is kind of a fundamental task of nation states, is to defend their borders. But local communities have a kind of a micro interest, which is in ensuring kind of peace between citizens. And sometimes that requires getting the cooperation of people who are outside the law in some other way. And I just wonder, Avedon, did you think in part this sanctuary question, it, in a way, it kind of pits people, it pits the two interests against each other. What do you think?
I think that with respect to a policy like San Francisco's, and again, it's one that's been widely embraced, and their policies like this and this response that ICE itself, by its own admission, in rolling out the PEP program, the Priorities Enforcement Program that Julie mentioned, but ICE's own admission that former regime under secure communities was not working. And I think that there's sort of this what's hasn't been mentioned in this conversation so far is that the type of cooperation, quote unquote cooperation, that ICE is asking of local governments, the localities have said we have an obligation under the Constitution to respect Fourth Amendment protections for people. And there's been a wave of litigation. There was a decision last year out of Oregon that made it very clear that for local governments to hold someone beyond any period that they need them for any of their own investigations would be a violation of that person's constitutional rights. So if ICE was interested in pursuing action against this individual, they were able to do so. I think there's a conflation around what's the role of local and state law enforcement. And if ICE wants to go, pursue this person, they were in a position where they were able to do so. I think it's really important to stress the fact that, local law enforcement, ICE, neither of those entities are above the law. They have to respect the constitutional protections for a person. And if there's no reason or no basis for San Francisco to continue to hold this person beyond what they needed him for, then their actions were appropriate.
Julie, can we ask Julie to respond to that, please?
Let me just respond to that. I think the district court decision in Oregon certainly could be challenged. This this administration kind of decided not to and decided to try to come to some common ground. Other administrations or other scholars might view it differently. But with respect to this particular individual and the idea that ICE could get a warrant, what's unfortunate is that ICE could not get a criminal warrant in this case against Mr. Lopez Sanchez. And the reason they couldn't get that criminal warrant is because they'd already done so. They'd already gotten that criminal warrant for him for reentry after removal, and he'd already served that time. That is part of the time he was serving the Bureau of Prisons. They could not get another criminal warrant on immigration charges when he was in San Francisco custody. That would be double jeopardy based on the same removal. Our civil immigration system currently is set up with the laws passed by Congress is not designed to have a judicially issued warrant. It's just not. And the system would also kind of break down if we had
judicial
warrants.
Why isn't it? Can I just ask about that? Why is it? Just because there isn't the capacity for that?
It's a civil system. It's right. Well, why would it break down?
Why isn't it set up? I mean, one would think that if a person has been removed and deported five times, has served, you know, years in prison on, let's just be clear that these have not been violent charges, but based on repeated illegal crossings, why isn't there an opportunity for judicial review to get a warrant? Is it because it's only based on the last incident, or is it just because the courts don't have the capacity?
It's because a warrant would not be necessary for his civil immigration removal. And so in order to charge him criminally, they would need to get the warrant in order, arrest warrant in order to charge him criminally for immigration violation for that. And they did that, and he served that time. What they would do here was remove him on an administrative order of removal, and it would be very streamlined, very quick, probably take a day. In some of the other instances where he was removed, it took about a day for it to go through, and that's because of his previous convictions. And that's the way Congress is set up the law for certain streamlined ways of removal for certain individuals who have violated our laws kind of time and time again. I think that Congress, as we think about a bigger issue and a national discussion, we ought to think about how do we want the system to work? Do we want every time for there to be a removal for the courts to get involved and for it to be a criminal immigration proceeding, or do we also want the civil immigration system? Right now we have both, and ICE uses both tools, but I think it's appropriate to have the discussion. But we've got to keep in mind kind of the ultimate public safety of the community. In this instance, the policy of San Francisco, which was very, very strict, and the sheriff, unfortunately, I know he had a lot of pressure on all sides, but the sheriff told his officers don't cooperate with ICE even informally. At the end of the day, this policy hurt San Francisco. It hurt Katy, and it was a mistake to have this policy to act in this way. And I hope that we can kind of think about how can we be more nuanced to try to come together in some way where there can be an agreement.
Let's take some calls from the community right now, who are listeners. We have a lot more time to chew over these issues. So, and you're both going to stay with us through the rest of the hour. But I'd love to hear from some callers now. Gray is calling from Oakland, California. Gray, what's your take on this?
Hello, Michelle. Hello to your guests. Black American calling here from Oakland. I work every day in the city of San Francisco. With all due respect to your guests, particularly one guest, she speaks of public safety as though it's a theoretical abstract. Anyone who lives here on the ground see the consequences, the repercussions of these sanctuary policies daily. There are open-air drug markets. They're on Hyde Street. The air of lawlessness here is really, really something which you would have to live here and see and behold to comprehend. And even then, you won't be able to comprehend it. What we speak of common sense approaches, we know here on the ground that those will never be instituted because they are the common sense is the antithesis of what they are trying to promote here. And a sanctuary policy for quote unquote undocumented workers, illegal immigrants, flies in the face of any type of common sense, because what we see here daily is that these people are not stupid. That's the first thing that we have to get out of our minds, that these people are some type of non-thinking, very basic people. These people are very smart. They are just as capable as any other human being, and they know. They come here. I have friends who are undocumented, illegal immigrants, I guess is that was the actual word, but they're undocumented workers, and they come here specifically because it is a quote-unquote sanctuary city.
Greg, we need to take a short break. I'm going to ask you to stand by because I have a couple of questions about some of the things that you brought up for us here, and I'm also asking our guests to stand by. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about immigration and what role local government should play in turning immigrants over to federal authorities. You can join the conversation. Do you see a scenario where the U.S. can be both inclusive and vigilant? With us this hour are Avidat Mousavian, an attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, and Julie Myers-Wood, who served as the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement from 2006 to 2008. Just before we took our break, we were talking about this whole question of whether these policies, do they in some ways kind of pit local safety versus kind of broader national aims? And do they, in fact, do these sanctuary policies make local communities safer? In an interview with CNN on Tuesday, the sheriff of San Francisco, Ross Mirkarimi, said that he believes that San Francisco is safer because it's a sanctuary city.
We're a world-renowned city with a large immigrant population.
Okay.
And of that population is a population that is also here undocumented. From a law enforcement perspective, we want to build trust with that population, and our sanctuary city and other attendant laws have allowed us to do that.
Now, before we took our break, one of our callers, Gray from Oakland, California, made the point. Gray, are you still with us? I mean, he made the point that that he felt that there's a lot of there's just a sense of lawlessness that you feel is promulgated by these policies. I wanted to ask, what convinces you that this atmosphere of lawlessness is in fact a result of high levels of undocumented immigrants, that they're the ones behind that? Because there are people who, I mean, I'm getting other comments from listeners who say that, look, this particular case, his immigration status has nothing to do with this crime. Any drug addict in San Francisco could have done the same thing, that this is just a tragedy, and this has nothing to do with his immigration status.
Well, that's exactly correct. But I'm not making the case for causality. What I'm saying here is that the general atmosphere of lawlessness is fostered by the idea that that they know that, you know, that there are no repercussions. When, again, there's six blocks, I can walk out my front door of my business right now and look down and walk down the street, and there's an open air drug market that takes place. I mean, right now we're here in the morning. We haven't even reached lunchtime yet. We're barely past breakfast, and people are selling drugs openly right now on the street. They're armed. They're drinking alcohol. The children out of school for the summer. The general air of lawlessness here, again, as I said, is unbelievable.
Again, I'm pressing the question: what's the relevance to this whole question about people's status or not? Are you saying that these are primarily undocumented immigrants?
Okay, let me put it this way: when people know that that the police won't stop, that they don't stop crime, when people know that, okay, if this man here will not be stopped for any criminal activity he does, he's committing. Because of, say, his illegal immigration status, then that attitude permeates to them as well. They don't feel that they'll be stopped. It's sort of like in New York, they did what they called a broken windows policing. Here, there's no policing for nearly anything short of, political murder. Do you know that after this woman was killed, there were two news stations who were videotaping at the scene. One of those news crews was robbed at gunpoint. They're live on TV, robbed of their news equipment. They're live on TV as they were reporting on this woman being killed at Pier 14. When you see that, you realize, we were making jokes about it at the work the next morning, but when I thought about it, I said, do you realize just how absolutely insane that is, that while you are reporting on a murder, you are then robbed at gunpoint and one of the cameraman pistol whipped and your equipment stolen from you.
Okay. Let's hear from our guests on this. I appreciate your perspective on this, Gray. So thanks for staying with us to kind of amplify your thoughts. Avidat Mousavian, what about that? I mean, what the gentleman is saying is that, you know, a failure to enforce some laws creates an environment of impunity. You think that's true?
No, I mean, a few comments to his remarks. First of all, I think, you know, just yesterday there was a report from the American Immigration Council that shows what we've heard time and time again, which is that there's no connection between undocumented immigrants and the numbers of undocumented immigrants in this country and increased rates of crime. And in fact, we've seen a reduction in the rates of crime, and particularly violent crime. The reality is we have over 11 million people who are contributing to our economy, to our communities, who are family members, our neighbors, our colleagues. These are people who have enriched this country. And I think to go to a point that Julie had made earlier, which I agree with, you know, San Francisco's policy and again, it's not unique. It's part of a trend across the country, a majority trend, I would say. And it's in direct response to the fact that nobody is saying that local police are not enforcing city law or state law when they do their job. Nobody's immune from or above the law in that respect. What they're saying is that we don't think that it's our role to enforce immigration law. And because we've got this situation that's much bigger than what's going on in our community, it's across the country. We've got over 11 million people who are here and who enrich our communities, but don't have an access, a path to status. So I think, you know, it would be a mistake to say that, you know, this one isolated incident, which as you have said, Michelle, you know, I don't think anybody would have predicted based on this person's history that this sort of deeply unfortunate death resulted, as a result of his being released. And I think that in particular, you know, no immigration policy that we have would have prevented this particular series of events.
Let me ask Julie. Let me ask Julie to respond to that, if I may. Julie, you heard Avita. She's saying that the circumstances here are so unique that the policy here really would not have prevented this. Thoughts about that?
I think San Francisco's policy allows bad things to happen. Certainly, bad things happen every day committed by U.S. citizens and others. And I would agree with Avita that his background does not indicate any violent tendencies, although maybe some unstable tendencies. He spent most of the last 17 years in federal jail, in fact, right? I was on, when I was in ICE, I was the recipient of a number of very painful phone calls when something like this would happen. And not necessarily because of a sanctuary city, but when there was an incident of violence or someone was murdered or something bad happened, and the person who did it was not here legally. And I think it just compounds the grief, the frustration of this could have been prevented. And so I would agree with Avita very much that bad things happen all the time. The lawlessness that the caller was talking about seems to go far beyond anything related to immigration. However, if we as law enforcement altogether can prevent someone from getting out on the street and can prevent tragedies, we ought to do that. And so we ought to think about if there's a way to do that in a way where all parties can come together on that piece.
Let's take another call from Boston. Jesse is calling. Jesse, what are your thoughts about this?
Hi, Michelle. You know, what I see here is the sanctuary policy is a response to the deeper issue of community distress of heavy-handed police tactics, and it's something we see not only in immigrant communities but as communities across the U.S. as a whole. And the danger I see right now is the framing of the sanctuary policy as the root of the problem rather than something that is there trying to fix a bigger problem that's going on with policing in our country. I lived in San Francisco for 6 years. My friend was murdered by East Bay local gang members in a robbery gone wrong. And, you know, the choice that we have here is how do we respond to this? Do we respond to this out of fear or do we respond to this out of love? I think it's, you know, very important that as we navigate this, it's a delicate situation. I mean, San Francisco itself, having lived there, there's a deeply rich community of, you know, people of various different backgrounds who really enhance it as a whole, and we need to, you know, consider that when you have isolated incidents like this and trying to frame a bigger problem.
Well, what do you think the response should be, Jesse? Do you have thoughts about that?
You know, I don't know exactly what the response should be, but what I see in this situation was a disconnect of communication between the different entities that were at play here. You know, you hear a lot of, oh, this was their fault and this was their fault. And no one's really taking full responsibility for what happened.
All right. Thank you for calling. We want to hear from Jillian now, who's calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Jillian, what are your thoughts about this?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Michelle. My thoughts are that I'm seeing this whole attitude towards undocumented immigrants as a whole new approved racism in our nation that is just absolutely appalling in my estimation, that anyone would even consider Donald Trump's comments having any merit. I just find it absolutely appalling that people could accept, you know, somehow smearing all undocumented immigrants because of one bad apple, so to speak. I feel like if the guy had been black and then people therefore smeared all black people, everyone would recognize the racism of it. But for some reason, the media just seems to be jumping on this sort of racist bandwagon of labeling all undocumented immigrants as being a problem. And
I'm not sure. I don't know that I agree that. I mean, it seems to me that there's been a lot of discussion about just what the relevance of his status is. I don't know that Donald Trump speaks for. I don't know that he speaks for anybody other than Donald Trump. And certainly a number of political candidates, other candidates, have spoken about his comments. I mean, I take your point. You think the broader issue for you, you feel, is that this incident is being used to malign immigrants more broadly. Is that right?
Right.
You think that's right?
And to once again spread an increased fear of undocumented immigrants, the vast majority of whom, I would say probably 99% of them, are wonderful, kind, hardworking, diligent people. I know so many of them here in the Boston area. And to smear the one bad apple. I mean, this happened in Massachusetts a few years ago too, where an undocumented immigrant was driving without a license and killed someone with his car. And so everyone suddenly is all anti-undocumented immigrant. Well, he happened to be an undocumented immigrant. If he had been a black person, would people therefore be afraid of all black people? You know, it's just, to me, it's just like a new nouveau racism that is completely accepted in our culture.
Okay.
I'm finding that appalling.
All right. Well, thanks for your thoughts, Jillian. Thanks so much. Let's take one more call. Let's hear from Ray, who's calling from Austin, Texas. Ray, what are your thoughts about this?
Hey, how's everybody?
Very well.
I work construction in Austin, and I work around a lot of illegal guys, illegal immigrants, and I'm going to call them like they are, and I won't use the derogatory term, but most of them are good people, but all this problem would be solved if none of them were here, then we wouldn't be talking about this guy offing somebody.
Okay. So what do you think is the way forward here, Ray?
Close the border. And go talk to Mexico, make it improve their political and social system so that I talked to these guys, and they say, I'd rather be home in Mexico. So if Mexico could improve their business, then we would not have all these people wanting to come over here illegally.
All right. Ray, thanks so much for calling. I think we have time for one more. David is calling from Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, what are your thoughts about this?
Hi, Michelle. I'll be quick. Two things. The Associated Press account that I read indicated that ICE asked for a status update after having turned over this person, the shooter, to the Sheriff's Department in San Francisco, and that San Francisco let him go, correct me if I'm wrong, the guess, and did not update ICE. And to me, as a layman, I looked at that as almost not only a sense of righteousness about their correctness in these matters, but almost a kind of defiance. And second of all, I just wanted to say, earlier in the show, someone mentioned that this shooter also had been in jail for heroin infractions.
Mm-hmm.
And you, Michelle, had mentioned at one point saying, well, his only, or the thing against him most was that he was nonviolent but had repeatedly crossed the border. And so I think the drug thing is being downplayed because heroin infractions, whether they involve someone else or not, are serious and are a threat to society. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Great. Well, there are. Thank you for calling. That's David, who's calling from Williamstown, Massachusetts. Well, we have a little bit of time left. So, Julie, do you want to respond to this? There's a number of things to chew on here. And I'm also interested in this whole question. We're getting also a lot of emails from people are reaching out to us on Twitter and Facebook and talking about this whole question of, you know, when is it okay to obey the law and when is it not okay to obey the law. There's just one I want to read from Talk1234, who said, gotta love how liberals are all for cities, states disobeying federal laws when it comes to, say, immigration and drug laws. But if a state wants to have its own laws for, say, marriage, abortion, and education, then it's like, what? You can't ignore the laws of the land. So there you are. A lot of discussion about, you know, who's being the hypocrite here. What are your thoughts, Julie?
Mm. I think our country is very conflicted with respect to immigration, and that's what you're seeing in the growth of the sanctuary cities and then also kind of the push against them. We have to kind of move beyond that for public safety. With respect to the caller's particular questions, ICE unfortunately never had this individual in his custody. He actually went from Bureau of Prison custody over into the city of San Francisco custody because I think the sheriff's office wanted to prosecute him. And the DA then, you know, it was an old case, probably didn't have enough information. What I think, though, is interesting in looking at Mr. Sanchez's background is he was prosecuted for reentry after removal a number of times criminally, and he served a lot of time for that. And the Border Patrol actually looks like they did a pretty decent job in finding him when he was trying to come back in again and again. And then the U.S. Attorney's Office was taking the cases, they were prosecuting him criminally, but that was not enough to deter him. And you know why? It's because of those jobs, because of the jobs. And he said, Mr. Sanchez said in one of his interviews that he was looking for a job either in roofing or a restaurant, mm-hmm. and this caller talked about construction. We need to fix our employment system and take away the magnet of illegal employment. Part of that's probably got to be fixing the demand side by fixing our legal immigration system and reforming that overall. But I think until we fix all these things, we're not going to have one voice in terms of federal, state, and local.
All right. Avidek, do you want to give a final thought here? I'm particularly interested in your perspective on whether anybody did anything wrong here, in your view.
Sure. I mean, I think San Francisco did not respond to the detainer that ICE had issued. And that's because these detainers have been found to be an ineffective tool and have been found to be unconstitutional in terms of mandating compliance with them. And that's why the city of San Francisco, it's not just this detainer, they routinely have not complied with those detainers that ICE has issued. And it's not alone in doing that. And I think that unfortunately this one single case is being used for some political expedience, not just on the part of presidential candidates, but from elected officials as well. And I think allowing one outlier case to inform policy would be very dangerous.
All right. Thanks so much for your perspective on this. Avida Mousavian is an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center. Thank you so much. Julie Myers-Wood is the former head of Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, ICE, for the Department of Homeland Security, now CEO of Guidepost Solutions. Julie Myers-Wood, thank you so much for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, the Confederate flag to come down in South Carolina, Greece in the balance, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.